We're exploring three books in the Bible known as the wisdom literature, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Job. And they're all asking the question, what does it mean to live well in this world?
So we've looked at Proverbs, who you could think of as a bright young teacher.
She's all about pursuing wisdom, an attribute of God that's woven into reality. And she's optimistic that if you use wisdom, you will build a successful life.
But then we come to Ecclesiastes, who's more like this sharp, middle-aged critic. And he says,
"You think using wisdom will bring you success. You'd better think again, because life here under the sun is meaningless."
And that's a phrase he uses a lot in this book.
But to understand this book, we have to realize first that we're hearing two voices.
So first there's the teacher, and we've been calling him the critic. He's the main voice in the book.
But he is introduced to us by another figure, the author. And he's the one who's collected the critic's words, and then at the end of the book summarizes everything and gets the final word.
So why does the author want us to hear from the critic?
Well, he wants to turn your view of the world upside down, and he's going to let the critic explore three really disturbing things about the world.
And we should warn you, these are pretty intense.
Yeah. So the first is the march of time, or as the critic says,
"Generations come and generations go, but the earth, it's been here long before us and will be long after. No one remembers people from long ago, and all the people yet to come, they too will be forgotten by those who come after them."
So, on a cosmic scale, you and I, we are just a blip. Stars are born, and then they die and form planets which orbit new stars, and those planets, they change over time and eventually burn up.
And amidst this cosmic backdrop, my entire existence is like a blink in time.
Which leads to the critic's second disturbing observation, that we are all going to die.
"Humans face the same fate as the animals, death. All people, the righteous and the wicked, the good and the bad, those who offer sacrifices to God and those who do not, they all share the same destiny. All this activity and madness, then we all join the dead."
Man, this book is depressing.
And so is the final disturbing thing for the critic, and that is life's random nature.
So in Proverbs, life isn't random. There's a clear cause and effect relationship between doing the right thing and being rewarded.
But the fact is that life doesn't always work that way. The critic has observed a glitch in the system. He calls it chance, or in his words,
"The race doesn't always go to the swift, or the battle to the strong. Nor does food always come to the wise, or wealth to the brilliant, or favor to the educated. Time and chance happen to them all."
So his point is that you can't really control anything in life. It's just way too unpredictable.
So if I want to master life,
then you're setting yourself up for a fall. Now, throughout the book, the critic uses a metaphor to tie together all of these disturbing ideas. Nearly 40 times, he says that everything in life is hevel. It's a Hebrew word that means smoke or vapor. Like smoke, life is beautiful and mysterious.
It takes one shape, and before you know it, it takes a new shape.
And smoke looks solid, but try and grab it, it'll slip right through your fingers.
And when you're stuck in the thick of it, like fog, it's impossible to see clearly.
Now, our modern translations have lost the metaphor, and they usually translate hevel as meaningless. But if you read closely, the critic isn't saying that life has no meaning, but rather that its meaning is never clear. Like smoke, life is confusing, it's disorienting and uncontrollable.
So what are we supposed to do with all of this?
Well, surprisingly, the critic first of all acknowledges the perspective of Proverbs. He says it's a really good idea to learn wisdom and to live in the fear of the Lord.
Really? I mean, he just said that doesn't guarantee success.
But he knows it's the right thing to do. But secondly, and more often, he says that since you can't control your life, you should stop trying. Learn to hold things with an open hand, because you really only have control over one thing, and that's your attitude towards the present moment. Stop worrying, he says, and choose to enjoy a good conversation with a friend, or the sun on your face, or a good meal with people that you care about.
The simple things in life.
Yes, and both the good things and the bad, because both are rich gifts from God. And that's the surprising wisdom of Ecclesiastes.
Listening to the critic is painful and can lead you into some dark places.
And that's why the author speaks up at the end of the book. He doesn't want you to lose hope. He wants to make you humble into someone who trusts that life has meaning even when you can't make sense of it, that one day God will clear the heaven and bring his justice on all that we've done. And so he tells us that the proper response to all of this is to fear the Lord and keep his commandments.
And that's the book of Ecclesiastes.
Meaningless. Everything is meaningless. If you want to watch more of those, you can search it on YouTube. It's the Bible Project. They have all kinds of videos on different Bible books. So if you weren't here last week, that's what we took up last week. Okay, so that's an overview of the book of Ecclesiastes. Hopefully that if you didn't get what I was trying to say last week, you got it from there. Again, if you weren't able to make it last week, watch that video again. It's on YouTube, or you can listen to the whole sermon from last week that's posted on our website, or you can subscribe to the podcast. Okay, so today we're gonna get into the meat of Ecclesiastes. So last week we took up the bookends of Ecclesiastes, just like what the book, what the video said. Ecclesiastes, there's two voices that we hear: the voice of the author and the voice of the preacher. The preacher is, for our purposes, is who? Solomon, king of Israel back in those days, son of David. Okay, and I say that because there are some theologians who say that it wasn't Solomon who spoke or who was speaking in Ecclesiastes. So, but for our purposes, it's Solomon. Okay, I'm going to agree with the majority of the theologians out there. So, as we begin the meat of the book here in chapter 1, let me remind you again: how are we going to read this book? How are we going to study this book? Because it is not the same. It is similar to how we read a New Testament book. Okay, now this book is in the Old Testament, so it contains a lot of metaphors or symbolisms, and we need to sort those things out first in order to determine context. Now, once we determine context, we can try then to extract application, okay? And hopefully that application will be usable. We will all be able to apply it in our daily Christian walk. Okay, so that's what we're going to do. So what we're going to do is going to read a portion of the chapter, define metaphors and symbolisms, determine context, and then extract the interpretation as well as the application. Okay, and that's where we're going. And remember what you just saw in the video. I'm going to keep referring to it, you know, over and over again, especially the three observations. One of the three observations that the preacher observed about our world is that, one, time keeps going on. It keeps marching on. It doesn't stop for anybody. Number two, we're all going to die. And number three, that life is unpredictable. You don't know what's going to happen. None of us do. So, okay. You better smile now. I'm going to wipe all those smiles off later on. No, just kidding. Anyway, let's go. Let's ready. Are you ready? Ecclesiastes 1, 1 to 3. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? So if I were you, I would get used to that word, vanity. Meaningless. Or if you want to say it in Hebrew, hevel. Okay. Hevel, everything is hevel. Get used to that book. We're going to keep seeing it until the very end of the book. Okay? So here's what we can see, okay, from the first three verses. What the preacher is saying in his opening statement is his thesis. You know, a thesis is something that he needs to prove. Okay? That's his thesis. And he will go on to try and show us why and how life is so hard to understand, much less define. That's what vanity means. Okay, that life is hard to define. It's like smoke. You don't know what it is. Is it solid? Is it liquid? Sometimes it's disorienting, right? It's confusing. That's what he's trying to prove for the rest of the book, that life is unpredictable and that life's meaning is vague and hard to grasp. Okay, then in verse 3, he continues and he says what? Verse 3 says, what does a man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? So he continues his statement by asking, what does man gain from all his work? Now, some of us, when we read that, we start thinking, but there is gain from work. That's why I work for the gain, right? Nobody here works for free. Anybody here work for free? Let me know, because I got a lot of stuff for you to do at my house, right? That's why we work, for gain. So why is he saying that there is no gain from all the work? Because when we work, and we work hard, and we work honest, we gain. What do we gain? Success, salary, and with salary comes what? Comfortable life. And a lot of us, that's our target. That's where we want to go. We want to have a comfortable retirement. We want to be successful. We want higher salaries. We want all of that stuff, right? But how come the preacher says that all work, there's no gain? What does man gain from all his toil? Or in other words, the preacher is saying that work is meaningless. It's vanity, right? I think what Jesus was trying to say in Mark 8:36. In Mark 8:36, Jesus said, "For what will profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul?" But the preacher says it in one word, vanity. It is all vanity. Or to put it in another way, nothing in this life will make sense if we only lived our lives based on what we can achieve within the confines of this world. If you live your life just chasing after success, money, pleasure, wealth, careers, name it, your life is not going to make any sense. Now, why? Isn't that what gives life meaning? Why does the preacher say that? So the preacher goes on and tells us that as much as life is unpredictable, he said it right at the beginning, that the first three observations was like time marches on, we all die, and life is unpredictable. As much as he tells us that life is unpredictable, and he says that in a sense that we cannot predict what's going to happen next. Like, we don't know what's going to happen. We're limited people. We only live in the present. None of us here knows the future. Right? Even the people who says they do, they don't. Nobody knows the future. In that sense, life is unpredictable. But in another sense, life is also a routine. You know what a routine is? Happening over and over again. That, in a sense, life also is predictable. So it is unpredictable, but it's also predictable. How? Let's go to Ecclesiastes 4. A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises, the sun goes down, and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes to the north. Round and around goes the wind. On its circuits, the wind returns. 7, all streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. So what the preacher is trying to say here is that even if life is unpredictable in one sense, there is still a pattern to it in another sense. In a sense that a generation comes. And that generation, they try to change the world. Right? And then what do? That generation passes away. Like, we're seeing it right now, right? What was the biggest generation before this generation? The baby boomers. They're slowly dying off. And some of them are still here. But the baby boomers, they're being replaced by the millennials. The millennials are now the biggest generation that is still alive today. So in a sense, the baby boomers, they tried to change the world. Did they succeed? Yes and no. But now that they're fading away, the millennials are setting up a whole new world. Right? So in a sense, what the baby boomers did was erased or built upon the millennials. Right? That's what's happening, right? There is a trend. There is a routine. Right? So time keeps running, right? And the world and all the generation has passed through it is headed to one end. And that is what? End of the world. It's still going there. It's not like the baby boomers stopped it from going there, or the millennials are going to stop it from going there. No, it's still going to go there. So in that sense, life is predictable, right? That's why preacher's conclusion is no matter how hard you work, either to make a difference in this world or to leave a legacy, in the end, all is hevel. All is vanity. All is hevel. Because why? Time will continue to run. It'll continue to march on. It's not going to stop for anybody. And will one day erase all memory of you and your work and whatever gain you think you may have achieved in this world. One day it's all going to be erased. In that sense, it's predictable. You know that that's going to happen. That's not going to change no matter how hard you work. So again, in that sense, life is pretty much predictable. The sun will rise, the sun will set. The winds will continue to blow every which way it wants to. All the streams will run to the sea and continue flowing. Right? All of this is to say that even nature testifies that we are stuck in this predictable circle going round and round. It's like running on a treadmill and not going or not getting anywhere. You're still in the same spot. Okay? It's like this. It's like when you cut your nails this week, next week, some of us, 3 weeks later, you let it grow and you cut it again. Just like what I said last week, me, I have the luxury of not having to cut my hair that often. But some of you, when you cut your hair today, give it 2 weeks. You got to cut it again. Anybody here who doesn't do any more laundry? Right? You do laundry, it gets dirty, you do laundry again. Right? And my oldest son even told me, why do I have to clean so clean? It's going to get dirty again. So I'm trying to teach him how to clean properly, and you know, teenagers, they're gonna give you that excuse, right? Or why do I have to keep taking a shower? I'm gonna get dirty again. The funniest one was with my nephew Matthias watching my dad cut grass. So my dad was cutting grass. After he cut the grass, he watered it. So Matthias, he's like, "Lolo, why are you watering the grass? Didn't you just cut it? You want it to grow again?" But that's what happens, right? You cut the grass, it grows again. We're stuck in this circle, in this routine, in this routine. So what does the preacher say about that? Verse 8. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. So what the preacher is saying is that since we're in this life, and this somewhat predictable life, sooner or later we get tired of it. If the same thing happens over and over and over again, sometime you will get tired of it. If you keep eating the same food every day, you will get tired of it. So what do you look for? Something new. I want something new. I need to change this routine of life, right? Like if I was to vlog about my life, nobody would watch it. You know vlogs? They put videos of their lives on YouTube, what they do. And it all seems exciting, like they do something different every day. But really, in reality, not all of us are doing that, right? Tomorrow, what are you going to do? I'm going to guess. Some of you are going to wake up early, shower, get dressed, go to work. Stop at Tim Hortons. Get the same thing you get every Monday. Right? And then what? After work, you go home. Some of you cook, change, watch a little TFC. And go to bed. And then on Tuesday, what are you going to do? Same thing. If nothing happens in between that is not a part of your routine, then you're doing the same thing over and over again. Maybe you change clothes. Some of you don't even change clothes. You still wear the same. Maybe, right? Or maybe you change what you order at Tim Hortons. But Otherwise, it's all the same. My life is the same thing. My everyday life is the same thing. That even though a bunch of things could happen, right? So in a sense, life is unpredictable that way. A bunch of things could happen. You could get into a car accident. You could get sick. It's not part of your routine. They could happen, but a lot of times when they don't, everything is routine. Everything happens the same. Life is unpredictable in one sense, but also routine in another sense. Admit it or not, this is how a majority of us live our lives. So what happens in the weariness of being in this routine day in, day out, the tendency is for most of us to seek for something new or something else. Some of us, it doesn't matter what that else is as long as it's something different, something new, right? We see this in verse 9 and 10. Check out 9 and 10. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. There's nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has been already in the ages before us. So what the preacher is saying again here is the reason we like to buy or acquire new stuff. That's the reason why. He's giving us insight as to why. Why do you like buying new stuff? Why do we want new experiences? Why do we go to new places for vacation? Because we want to get out of this routine of life. Right? That's why we like. That's why we go to new places. That's why we want to taste new food. That's why we want to buy new things. Right? Preacher is saying that because life is routine and this routine gets tiring, people like to pretend that there is something new to life by always looking to fill it with new things. But just like what he said, is there anything new? No. But we like to think that there is, right? So when you get tired of work, I'm going to call in sick today. Get tired of your house, let me change the paint color. Let me buy a new TV. Just to get out of that routine, whether that be shoes, clothes, bags, electronics, new cars, going to see new places, checking out new movies, new restaurants, tasting the new food craze. We do it because we want to get out of this routine. Right? And the preacher's response, nothing is new, everything's done already. What you're doing is all vanity. Right? Now, why do you think he says that? I think he says that because it doesn't matter how much new stuff you get, all of that stuff will get old. We used to enjoy going to Collingwood when we first got Collingwood. Who's been to Collingwood? Oh, we used to love going there. Oh, yeah. This year, it's like, I don't know. Collingwood again. Right? Because it's gotten old. And everything is going to get old. And when they get old, they fall into your routine. It just becomes part of your routine. Right? No matter how many new places you visit, one day you will feel like vacation itself is a routine. Like vacation again? I was just on vacation again. But if you're at work, the other people at work say, work again? I want to go on vacation. And you're on vacation. Vacation again? I need to go back to work. It becomes part of your routine, no matter how many new flavors of ramen you taste. And I'm a sucker for ramen. I keep looking for the new ones. But every time I taste a new flavor, it's ramen. It's still ramen. Before it was burgers. I taste all kinds of burgers. I even went to the States to eat a burger. After a while, it's just a burger. It's just being part of your routine. It all becomes part of our routine. The preacher is saying that our pursuit for new things is nothing but a distraction to the routine we are already in. And that these new things will sooner or later become part of that routine. So the routine of your routine of work, home will change to work, home, shopping or work, home, vacation. But after a while, it's work, home, vacation, work, home, shopping, work, home, vacation, work, home, shopping. Still a routine. It becomes part of it, right? And I want you guys to be brutally honest with yourself right now, okay? If we are brutally honest, like be honest with yourself. New stuff, new anything, brings an emotional response of excitement to life, doesn't it? Because when it's routine, there's no more excitement. That's why people find new wives, new husbands. Because they're bored with their wives. Let me find a new. Because it gives a sense of excitement. Why do you buy a new phone if your phone is still working? Because it gives a sense of excitement. Why do you try new food? Why do you go to new places? Why anything new. It brings a sense of excitement to life. To the point, even when you find an old thing, right? Like I found my old Walkman from the 90s. You know what a Walkman is? With a tape. I know, millennials. What tape? What's a tape? It's this thing with a plays a tape, right? I found it in the basement. I haven't seen it for 20 years, right? To the point where when you see an old thing that you haven't seen for a while, it's new. It brought an excitement. I started to buy batteries for it, looked for my tapes, the voice tapes I used to make for Jay. You know what voice tapes are? None of you. Never mind. That was how illegal back in the day. You found it and you're so excited about it. Oh man, this is new because I haven't seen it in a while. Even in that sense, new brings a certain kind of excitement. But really, that's old. Right? You look at your pictures. The pictures that you haven't seen in a while. Right? It becomes new again because you haven't seen it in a while. But at the same time, it brings excitement because it is new. It broke you out of the routine. Right? And that's what happens, right? And here's what's funny. I watched these YouTube videos about kids buying their parents' old cars back. You guys watch that? There's some kids that you know, they have a backstory to it. Oh, my dad used to own this Chevy, whatever, back in the 60s, but he had to sell it to help our family because we were short in finances, blah, blah, blah. Now that he's older and he can afford to, he goes and looks for the same exact car, right? And he buys it for his dad. And the dad sees it, and the dad starts crying. It's my old, you know, blah, blah, blah. And gets excited about it. There's an emotional response to it. While watching this, I'm amazed how much emotion a non-living thing brings to a person. You don't have any relationship with this car. The car is a car. It doesn't respond. It's just a piece of metal with wheels and an engine. That's all it is. But the emotion that it brings out on people is sometimes crazy, right? Sometimes, some may say that emotion is from the act of the giving, like a sentimental thing. That's what gives it emotion. But in the end, the emotion is hooked up to the car, right? If you didn't see the car, there would be no emotion. But a lot of times, that's how, you know, it's weird how inanimate objects has an emotional effect on us. Isn't that weird? Inanimate, like non-living objects. Right? Like, I can remember the first time when I got my first car, my very first car. And I was cleaning it, and somebody scratched it while I was cleaning it. I was so angry, I was going to cry. So angry, somebody just keyed it. Right? Or when I used to buy new shoes, I used to sleep with them. When I used to buy the Air Jordans, the Air Pennies, the first, especially the pennies, the first pennies. Do you guys know the first pennies, those shoe heads here? Sneaker heads? Number one, penny ones? Whew. I slept with that thing, you know. I would wear it, clean it so I could sleep with it. And when it got dirty, somebody step on it, I'd be so angry. Like, you ever wonder how weird that is? Do you guys react to anything like, or is it just me? I'm just the weird one here. Do you? When somebody messes with your stuff, There's an emotional attachment. There's some kind of emotion to it. But when you think about it, that's an object. Why do we cry over things like that? Or why do we feel anger? Why do we feel emotion when it comes to objects? Like somehow our sense of self-worth is connected to this thing. That somehow owning a new cell phone or the latest sneaker validates you as a person and gets you out of that routine of a life that you've been living. Somehow stuff has that effect on us. Right? Now the preacher is saying what? Give me a break. That's a shoe. Or that's a car. It is all vanity. In the end, no matter what shoe you're wearing, no matter what cell phone you carry, you're still you. You didn't change. You didn't change. You wore Michael Jordan shoes, you became Michael Jordan? No. I was already Michael Jordan when I wore the shoe. You don't. No matter what kind of suit you wear, if it's Armani, if it's whatever, it's still you. It's still, you're still not a supermodel. Right? No matter what phone you carry, no matter what stuff you have, you're still you. The only thing that probably changed is the money you had in the bank. Maybe it's a little less now because you had to buy that new cell phone. But that's it. Nothing else changed. Right? Now think about that. Think of all that stuff that you carry to get, that you chase after to get out of this routine. Meanwhile, all we're doing is creating a whole new routine. We're just adding on to our already existing routine with stuff. That's what we're doing. Next thing you know, you're bored. Next thing you know, you're tired with it. And like I said last week, there are some people who are so into chasing stuff that sooner or later it'll land them into debt. That they want so much stuff that their work can't afford it anymore, they borrow. Remember that? Who's the number one country when it comes to household debt? Oh, Canada. Canada, number one. Why? What's the main problem? Because of this. Because of the routine that we have here. We work hard. The work days here are long and then they're tiring. We want to break out of that. So what do? We pretend that there is something new under the sun. And we keep buying new stuff. Next thing you know, that stuff is part of the routine and we're in debt. Right? So that becomes a whole new routine for some people. Some people, that becomes a permanent routine. Buy stuff, borrow, pay debt, work to pay the debt, buy stuff, borrow. Am I lying or? So all you did was added a new thing to your routine. Sometimes that new thing is debt. And you don't want to go down that road, right? None of us do, right? But it's ironic, isn't it? It's ironic that, you know, how you began this routine by wanting to acquire stuff, and because you got into debt, in the end, you lose all the stuff. Isn't that ironic? Because of your desire to get more and more stuff, in the end, you end up with nothing. That's very ironic. Right? It's also ironic how the preacher ends this part of the sermon by saying, no matter how much stuff you get, how much wealth you acquire, how much success you achieve, in the end, time is the great eraser. I said that last week. Right? Time is the great eraser. Check out verse 11. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. What's the preacher's response? None of us will be remembered. Time will erase everything. Time will erase every memory of us to the point where the only people who can remember you are probably already dead. And then those who come after them will have very little to no memory of you. Fun book, right? Anybody enjoying this book? No, just me. Just me. Right? That's why we go back to the preacher's opening statement. It's pretty much his conclusion or his thesis. He says that all is vanity. Striving to get out of the routine of life by pursuing or toiling for things in this world is vanity, because one day our time will end and we will all be erased. Let's keep moving. 12 and 13. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. So here the preacher gives us an insight as to what he will be doing in the next chapters. Namely, what he's going to be doing is he's going to indulge all his five senses. What are the five senses? Sight, smell, taste, see, hear, right? He's going to indulge all of those senses with anything and everything that he can get his hands on, in order to gain wisdom to finally make sense and give meaning to life. And it's funny how he says, I am the preacher, I am the king over Israel in Jerusalem. Meaning he has the resources to do this. He has the resources to actually indulge in everything that he can get his hands into to stimulate all his senses. And some of us, oh man, I wish that was me. I don't have the money to do that. But this guy does. King over Israel. He has everything. Now, the key, okay? The key to finding wisdom and ultimately making sense of life is not found in the experiences that the preacher will be indulging himself in. Okay? It's not found there. Or the experiences that his five senses will bring. The key to finding wisdom is not found in those things. We're going to see that the key to finding wisdom from these experiments that the preacher will perform is to be convinced that there is eternity to follow. That there is a life after this one. Because if there is not, then all these things, again, time will erase. So it doesn't matter if you get as rich as Solomon or as poor as who? Lazarus. It doesn't matter. You're going to be erased anyway. So the key is there has to be something else. If there is nothing else, yeah, Paul says, eat, drink, be merry. Because that's it. This is it. We're done. Might as well enjoy yourself here. Right? And without that key, the only wisdom that can come from these experiments of indulging the five senses is to show us, you know, how to live our lives or how to live our meaningless lives a little better. That's all you can get out of this if you don't have the key. And just like what I said last week, ultimately, what will give meaning to our lives is what we find meaningful. Think about what you find meaningful. That's ultimately what will define or give meaning to your life. Right? And a lot of times, we base that or we put that on things that are here on this earth. Okay? Which will be erased one day. So when that gets erased and your meaning is in there, your life is meaningless. That's why the preacher says, all is vanity. Let's keep going. 12 to 15. Again. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is unhappy business that God has given the children of man to be busy with. I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity in a striving after the wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. So ultimately what the preacher is saying is that these experiments that the preacher is about to perform were written to show us what we find meaningful. To show us that what we find meaningful, what our five senses find satisfying are nothing compared to the joy and satisfaction we can experience through a sixth sense, another sense. And that sense is what? Faith. In the end, it all comes down to that. It all boils down to that sixth sense. So apart from faith, the preacher is saying, life is but a striving after the wind. Right? Life will be like chasing after something that will satisfy us for a brief moment. And then as quickly as that moment of satisfaction came, it will also fade away for us to chase after again. So you're back on that treadmill. You're back on that routine. Again, this is why the preacher's conclusion to life is vanity. It's meaningless. If you just keep doing this over and over and over again without purpose, without direction. Right? 16. I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. 17. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is a striving after the wind. For in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. So what the preacher is saying here is that in his experiments, not only did he indulge in his riches, he also went the other route and experienced what it was like to be poor. Not only did he apply his art to wisdom, but also to madness and folly. So he didn't just look at one side of it where he just indulge. He also looked at the other side. What does it feel to be poor? What does it feel to indulge or to apply my wisdom to madness or folly? Right? What's funny here is that the rich, okay, when we look at our society, the rich always talks about simplifying life. Like life is too complicated for the rich. So they want to simplify it. While the poor always dreams about being rich. Right? And there's no poor here. We're all rich. But you know how it is, right? When before it's all about big furniture in your house, right? Big everything in your house. Now, no. Let's simple living. Just one couch, one chair, right? One TV or no. TVs, always 5 TVs in the house. But, you know, we try to simplify life because we are, we're not rich, but we are rich compared to the rest of the world, right? So Solomon is saying that it's funny how that happens. Like the rich always want to simplify, the poor always wants to be rich. Like look at the rich and famous, right? They talk about how they want to become normal people again. Like they want to go to the malls and not have a bunch of people asking them for autographs. They just want to be normal. Right? The poor and the unknown, on the other hand, has a different dream, right? They want to be asked for an autograph. I want to be known someday, right? They want to experience the life of the rich. What the preacher is saying is, I did both. I was poor. I did the rich thing. I did the wise thing. I did the foolish thing. And his conclusion is what? Life is meaningless. Vanity. Same thing. Vanity. Being both rich and being poor is vanity. And wisdom, same thing. Vanity. With much wisdom comes much vexation, comes much anger. With much knowledge comes much sorrow. I experienced that here in this church. Right? I know a lot of things about some people here that none of you know. And sometimes you just say, I don't want to know all these things because it brings so much frustration, so much sometimes anger. Because you know, right? Because you know. One commentary said, the more he learned, the more he realized what he didn't know. And the more he knew, the more he knew life's sorrows. Right? That's why a lot of people that, that I open up with about the problems of this church, not like the private ones, just little things that I'm frustrated with when it comes to our church. Not that there's a lot of them, there's just a lot, but not much. Some of them are telling me, why don't you just leave that church? Go to our church. Our church is perfect. So I asked them, so are you active in your church? No, I just go there every Sunday. Well, you don't know. That's why there's no vexation. If you knew, you would be vexed. And a lot of people, when they knew, they leave. Well, that's not the answer, right? That's a different topic. But anyway, but that's what it is, right? The more you know, the more you get vexed. Like if you know your child to be this, nice girl at home or nice guy at home, not knowing the rest of them when they're out there, you will be vexed when you find out. right? So the more you know, the more it comes with. No, the more knowledge comes sorrow or vexation. It's like looking at a city from an airplane before you land. Everything looks clean and everything looks beautiful, right? From up there. Then you get to the streets. You get to the ground. You see crime. You see hate. You see neglect. You see the poor. You see everything. Now, while I was writing this, I can't help but to think about Jesus and how much he loved, or how much love it took him to leave his throne up there where all is well with God the Father. Everything was fine with them up there, him and his Father together, right? How much love did it take for him to come down, land where he can taste, see, smell, touch, and hear all the sinful hatred of humanity towards God? How much love did that take to be able to do that? Right. But even then, what drove Christ, the man of sorrows, to go through with his mission on the cross? He said that it was the joy, the satisfaction that comes from knowing God, right? Knowing God the Father. And the key, again, the key to living a life with meaning, a life with a clear purpose, is to what? Live it in faith in the Son of God, because he knows how to deal with it. And he knows where to put your life or how to spend your life that will make meaning of your life. That's why you put your faith in him. That's why that's the key to the wisdom of Ecclesiastes. Without that, again, Solomon is just telling you what to do so that you can live maybe a better life if you can afford it. Now, I know that everything that the preacher has said so far, you know, it doesn't exactly bring joy and hope to a lot of us. Okay. Now, so here's what I want us to take away from today's sermon. And pretty much all the sermons in Ecclesiastes. And I want you to listen carefully. If you're going to stay awake for this one. Okay. Those of you who are sleeping, okay, I know, I take notes. I know who you are, mental notes. Okay. If you're going to take something away from this, listen to this. Until you honestly look at your life through the preacher's eyes and evaluate what you find meaningful in this life, you will never understand why the key to living a meaningful life comes from knowing the Son of God and believing in him as your only source of hope and salvation. Until you become honest with yourself of what that is that you find meaningful, you're not going to see Jesus as of any value. And when you think about that, there's two steps to that, right? Number one, be brutally honest with what you hold of value. And a lot of us, sometimes we try to justify what we hold of value. Well, I need it. Or it's what keeps me going. Or it's what, you know, unwinds, help me unwind. Well, if you hold that of too much value and you live for that, whatever that thing is, it's going to drive you further and further away from the truth. Next thing you know, your time is up. And then what? Right? And then what? Right? That's what you need to assess. That's what you need to be brutally honest with. Right? Until you're ready to assess your life and admit to yourself that what you hold of value and what you hold meaningful all revolves around the satisfaction that comes from the things under the sun, until you resolve that in yourself, you will continually be stuck in the routine of life. You will still be running on that treadmill. Until you don't realize that this is what I'm doing, this is my life. Running on a treadmill, doing the same thing over and over again, no matter how much new stuff I put in, until you realize that and admit to yourself that that's it, you'll continue to run on the treadmill. You continue to toil under the sun, as Solomon said. And what are you going to have to show for it when your time runs out and eternity starts? Nothing. Can bring nothing with you. So you ran, toil, dead. Eternity starts, empty hands. Bring nothing with you. Until you realize that, until you admit that and be brutally honest with yourself, the preacher's words will continue to echo in your life. And what is his words? Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. Is there hope? Yes. There's good news. The good news is it doesn't have to be that way. You don't have to live your life that way. That's why we're doing this book. So you don't have to. If you would just listen and be honest with yourself, right? The wisdom in this book is calling us to go beyond what this world can offer. Beyond the satisfaction that we find in this world. And see it with faith, right? That's the only way you can see it. With faith. The good news is that life does not have to be lived in vain. That there is meaning that could be found in life, and it's found beyond this world and can only be found by faith. Some of you get what I'm saying. If you don't get what I'm saying, search for that, chase that, try to get the understanding and knowledge of what I'm trying to say, what the key is to live a meaningful life. And when you truly grasp that, even for those of you who do get what I'm saying, but have not put that on the road, have not put the rubber to the road, have not applied it, and are still chasing after these little things that you think will get you out of the routine. Meanwhile, all you're doing is creating a whole new routine for yourself. Until you get that, until you grasp that, you'll be running on a treadmill. But when you do get it, when you do understand what I'm trying to say here, our lives will begin to make more sense. And ultimately, our lives will not be wasted. We only have one. Unless you're a cat. We all only have one. And Solomon is saying, I've tried all of these things. I've tried everything. None of it will matter afterwards. So stop chasing after it. Find your meaning. Okay, in something that is outside of this world, that's something that your five senses cannot see. Find your meaning in Christ. Find your meaning in God. That's why he said at the end, right? What did he say at the end? His conclusion in Ecclesiastes in verse 12, what? Fear God and obey his commandments. How are you going to do that if you're not a believer? You can't. That's why it's the key. If you don't know Christ yet, if you don't know who Jesus is, if you don't know how valuable he is, that he's more valuable than anything else in this world that you think is valuable, then you don't get it. You don't have the key yet. Believing in Jesus is not just saying, yes, I believe, or praying that prayer, or being baptized. It's not none of that stuff. It's preferring him over everything else. Wanting him over everything else. That's what the key is. Right? And I'm saying this because as we go through the experiments, we're all going to think, oh no, nothing makes sense. It will, and it does, if you have the key of faith, right? That's ultimately what this whole book is about, right? So don't get discouraged. Oh, talking about, oh, so nothing makes sense. I'm just going to stay home. I'm not going to go to work. I'm going to quit my job. I'm not going to cut my nails anymore. I'm not going to take a shower. I'm not going to mow the lawn. I'm not going to clean my house. It's going to get dirty again. Forget it. That's not what I want you guys to come away with this. No. I want you to say, oh, I get what Solomon is saying. He's tried everything. This is the only thing that makes sense to him. Trust in God, obey his commands, or fear the Lord and obey his commandments. Right? Because next week, that's what we're going to do. Next week, we go start chapter 2. In chapter 2, he details what he does. How did he indulge his five senses? Right? And I want us to have this in mind so that when you do look at chapter 2, the thinking, I don't want you to think, oh man, I wish that was me. No! Especially men, right? 700 wives? Oh, I wish that was me. Some of us, no, I don't want that. I want the money. No, that's not the point of this whole thing. The point is this, that even though he did have fun, it didn't make sense for him. That's the point, okay? That's what I want to prepare you for next week. And hopefully I'll see you again next week. Hopefully this didn't drive you away. Amen? Okay, let's pray.